All right. Thanks everybody for coming. Welcome to the Breck Forum. We are, well, first of all, we're very happy to host this event tonight. Dan's new edited volume, Histories of Radicalism. And we're here, of course, with Andy, Vicky, Matt Meyer, Meg, Ben, and everybody who we've come to know and love here in the New York City left radical community. The Breck Forum is actually celebrating, we are celebrating our 35-year anniversary this year. If there's one date that you should mark down on your calendar, and there's a bunch because we have programming basically every single night between now and December 10th, but there's one date that I want you guys to keep in mind. It is Monday, November 15th, where we're going to be hosting, some have called it the party of the year, others the party of the century. I'm not going to like put a label on it per se, but suffice to say it's going to be a really cool evening. We're honoring David Harvey, longtime Capital teacher here at the Brecht, and also Baravi Desai, Taxi Workers Alliance Executive Director. And we're trying to rope Harry Belafonte into accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award. I don't know if it's going to happen. We're sitting down with his people really soon, so he might be on the dance floor as well. For anyone who's seen David Harvey on the dance floor, you know what that's like. Yeah. I hope you guys can be there. It's also, of course, a fundraiser and an important one for the Breck Forum as we head into our 36th year. So think about that, and you can get tickets for that online at breckforum.org, as well as just kind of check out all the other programming that's going on here. There's also a calendar at the front desk, in case you haven't picked it up. So, having said that, and congratulations to all the authors and Dan on the new book, I will turn it over.
Great. Right. Thanks. Thanks, Max, and Kazembe, and everyone else at the Breck for hosting us, and thank you all for braving, I guess, a nor'easter, I'm told, to come out tonight to hear us talk about the hidden 1970s. Histories of Radicalism. I'm grateful to have spent the past few days in New York doing a variety of book events, but this one is perhaps the most exciting because it's all of the New York City contributors and myself. So I just want to say a little bit about the book. There's so many of us here, and it's a really great opportunity to have just a dialogue about social movements in the 1970s and what there is to learn from them and how they shape our work today. And so we're all just going to speak for a few minutes, maybe about 5 minutes, and then we can have a great discussion. We may at some point be joined in the discussion by a variety of very small, very cute people, one of whom is making a guest appearance here. And we're really grateful that they are honoring us with their presence, and their contributions, voluntary or otherwise, are most welcome. So we'll all have a great time together. So, you know, the driving force for this book is, you know, not just to have some more specificity when people talk about 60s and social protest in the 60s, to really point out the fact that actually a lot of what we think of as happening in the 60s as an era took place in the 1970s as a decade, but also to try and think about what is particular to the 1970s, right? And those histories, obviously, that have not gotten attention, those hidden histories that continue, that not only were dynamic and innovative in their own time, but that continue to shape the structure of radicalism, the structure of protest and organizing to this day, right? And there are several contributions along those lines. We're going to hear about six of them today. And we're going to start off with Matt Meyer, who is a longtime organizer with the War Resisters League, the author or editor of, I believe now, 5 books on violence and nonviolence and African social movements, and Matt will talk about his
and
stuff.
One on political prisoners that they're and selling back there.
One on political prisoners called Let Freedom Ring, which is a 1,000-page volume about the last 30 years of organizing around political prisoners in the U.S. And I think what, before I turn it over to Matt, the only thing I'll say as a sort of overarching comment is what I think stands out about the 1970s as distinct from the 1960s is a time when the radicals of that period really started to walk their talk in a way that was new and that was different. And for some, that was right, doing what they had rhetorically been arguing for a long time about, you know, armed struggle or building a communist party or any other manner of direction. But for others, for those who just came of political consciousness in the 1970s, walking the talk took a new term, right, and a new importance. And I think what cuts across all of them is a sense of innovation and experimentation. Just to be clear, that's not what cuts across the entirety of 1970s social movements. There is a lot of almost comically sectarian foolishness and other things that we don't need to rehash today, although they are an important part of the story, right? But the sort of hidden 1970s, the things that are not, that are not a part of the historical record quite as much, are those things that are a lot more innovative and exciting. So we'll start off with Matt in that regard.
Great. Thank you, Dan, and congratulations, Dan. So I want to say a couple of things. I mainly decided not to speak tonight. I'm going to read poetry because we have enough speakers. But I'm going to say a couple of little things. I'm really excited to be here tonight, not just because it's the Brecht, not just because of my esteemed colleagues who I'm excited to be with, not just because it gave me an excuse to sort of wear a kind of 60s, 70s love beats kind of thing. But I'm excited because I feel like this book goes a long way, more than most, in correcting an historical problem that the left movements have had in this country. There are, as I would guess most, if not all of you in this room already know, a library full of books about the 60s. And those books, largely because they were written from a memoirist point of view in many cases, and they were certainly written with an appropriate sense of urgency and immediacy, nonetheless, I think, failed to understand or look at or portray the 60s in historical context. And I think probably from my point of view, as someone who missed the 60s by virtue of being too young, just by a little bit, despite the gray hair, one of the things we've tried to piece together in reading this library full of books about the 60s is not only what the lessons of that era are for us, but also what pieces of the truth each of these books have and how we can put those pieces together into something meaningful for future generations. Having said that, I think the number one most significant myth or mistake about the 60s that, again, this book goes a long way in beginning to correct is that the 60s were a time period in U.S. history that began more or less in 1960 and ended at the end of the 1960s. Now, one could understand why, in understanding the 60s, this mistake could be made. But in fact, I think, from a historical point of view, the period of time that the left means and the right means when we talk about the 60s is that period of time that begins somewhere around 1954 and ends in the late 1970s. And this book understands that. This book was put together with that understanding as its reference point. And by looking at the hidden 70s, this book, I think, helps us reclaim and understand strategically what it means to have a movement that starts out very small and in the shadow of great repression, that has some rises and zeniths, and that then faces another period of repression. And the hidden 70s is a piece of the history of the 60s that we ought to know, that we better know, if we're going to prepare for this next 10-year period in my evaluation. So that is part of why I'm really excited and really proud to be here tonight in what I hope will hopefully will be a series of conversations that we have with our comrades here at the Brecht about this coming period. So I'll say a sentence about my chapter before poetry. My chapter is co-written by a comrade from the Catholic Worker based in Washington, D.C., named Paul Magno, and it's called Hard to Find, Building for Nonviolent Revolution and a White Pacifist Underground. Okay. You'll hear some, I think, from others about groups that were doing work in the nonviolent sector of the movement in the 1970s. And certainly you'll hear from others tonight, and you'll read in the book about the many organizations that were, as Dan started to say just now, beginning to put their money, to put their bodies, to put their actions where the rhetoric had been. And that is a feature of the 70s. But it's not just about armed struggle, and it's not just about the characterization of the many militant actions that took place throughout the 70s. A piece of that militancy, not the most important piece, but a piece of it, the piece that I examine in the chapter I co-wrote, was looking at that group of radical pacifists, that group of radical nonviolent activists who saw themselves very centrally as part of the revolution, who saw the overthrow of the U.S. racist, sexist, capitalist state as their priority. The empire had to go. But who saw, from their point of view, the use of nonviolent means, at least for their own selves, they weren't necessarily preaching it to the rest of the movement, as a priority. And those groups, though later, got more popularity, got more spotlight, and got some sense of acceptance from at least the rest of the left and some parts of mainstream society, in the 70s, those groups were just as repressed, or maybe not just as, but those groups were also repressed and were also, in some cases, driven, in other cases, choosing to be underground and clandestine as other parts of the movement. So, very briefly, my chapter outlines some of the work of the nonviolent left in property destruction, and that... Oh my goodness, I haven't even started the poem yet.
Hello.
All right, well, I can read the poem very quickly. This is New York, so I can read it faster than I can in Philadelphia, right? Property destruction, where draft files are burned. Okay, and then you look at property destruction where buildings are blown up, but there aren't people in the buildings. You know, one says, oh, is one property okay to destroy and other property not so okay? You have nonviolent activists who are in dialogue with national liberation movements and with groups like Weather Underground. And then you have some groups who are quietly or not so quietly dropping out and trying to create alternative systems, either on communes or in some cases overseas in Canada, etc. You're going to have to read my chapter to find out more, because I really am committed to reading this poem. I got the title for my chapter from a poem by Dan Berrigan, which I think speaks to a lot of some of the energy of the radical nonviolent movement of the 70s, and it's called America is Hard to Find, and I'm going to read it in, 1 minute and 4 seconds. Wild strawberries, swans, herons, deer, those things we long to be, metamorphized in and out of our sweet, sour skins. Hard to find. Free form men and women, harps, hopes, food, mandalas, meditations, hard to find. America. Now, if America is doing well, you may expect Vietnamese to do well. If power is virtuous, the powerless will not be marked for death. If the heart of man is flourishing, so will plants and wild animals. But alas, alas, so also vice versa. Hard to find. Good bread is hard to find. Of course, the hands are wielding swords. The wild animals fade out like Alice's cat's smile. Americans are hard to find. The defenseless fade away like 100-year pensioners. Fly it. Turn it on. Become hard to find. Become, be born. Out of the sea Atlantis, out of the wilds America, these words like manna, miraculous loaves and fishes exist to be multiplied, savored, shared. Play it, learn it, have it by heart. Imagine intelligence. Imagine peaceable, caressing food, planting music, making hands. Imagine. Come in. P.S. Dear friends, I choose to be a jailbird. One species is flourishing. In a kingdom of fowlers, like strawberries, good bread, swans, herons, Great Lakes, I shall shortly be hard to find. An exotic, uneasy inmate of the nationally endowed, electronically inescapable zoo. Remember me. I am free, at large, untamable, not nearly as hard to find as America.
It's a shame to end the poetry of the evening so early, but well, we'll see what happens as the event goes on. So next we're going to hear from Vicky Law, who works with New York City Books Through Bars and is the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Invisibility of Women Prisoners. Which is an excellent book that's also for sale in the back.
Do I need to sit here? Can I stand up?
Do what you want.
All right. Hey, everybody. I'm going to stand up so I can go over there and see everybody as opposed to only half of the room. Before I start, I'd like to sort of ask a couple of questions to see where people are at. By a show of hands, how many of you have heard of Inez Garcia? How many of you have heard of Joanne Little? Jenna Kelsey? Barbara Gilbert? Beverly Ibn Tomas? Kathy Thomas? All six of these women were incarcerated for defending themselves in the 1970s. Only two of these women, however, received any sort of outpouring of support from the left that enabled them to basically have their convictions overturned and to be free. I'm going to go into brief summaries of each of these cases. I will warn you, I am going to be talking about abuse and sexual abuse. So if this is something that makes you uncomfortable or triggers you, feel free to leave or do something to take care of yourself. But there's kind of not really a way to talk about these cases without talking about what happened to these women. In 1974, there was a woman named Inez Garcia living in California with a roommate. Two men entered her house and threatened her to rough up her roommate, and then they took her into an alleyway in the back of the house, and one man blocked the alleyway while the other man raped her. They left, and then they called her up and they threatened her with further harm. Hearing this, Inez Garcia took out her gun and went looking for these men, and she shot and killed the man who had blocked her escape during this attack. She was arrested and charged with first degree or premeditated murder, but her cause was taken up by the women's movement at the time. So there were women's liberation movements, people from the Chicano liberation movement, people from the Black Panther Party all came out in support of the fact that a woman had the right to defend herself against sexual assault, even after that assault had happened, and that she had a right to defend herself from further harm. After a circus of a trial in which the judge basically refused to allow any testimony about the sexual assault into the case, Inez Garcia was convicted of first-degree murder. But the women's movement continued to rally around her behalf. They petitioned the governor, they rallied around the judge, they continued to hold fundraisers and press conferences and draw attention to her case and to basically pay for further legal support. And they hired a feminist attorney named Susan Jordan to take over her defense. 2 years later, 2 years after Inez Garcia had been convicted and imprisoned, the California Court of Appeals reversed her conviction because the trial judge had instructed the jury not to consider her assault when deliberating on her self-defense plea. And during this retrial, Susan Jordan challenged potential jurors about the preconceptions of the rape, making the assault an integral part of the case from the get-go, rather than making it something that wasn't talked about. And as a result, Inez Garcia was acquitted. The entire jury agreed that both the rape and the threat of further harm were adequate provocation for her shooting and killing her assailant. And this acquittal established a legal precedent that extended the interpretation of imminent danger beyond the immediate time period. Basically, that a woman or a person doesn't have to be in the midst of an attack to be able to defend Tamar herself. And this laid the groundwork for what later became known as the battered woman's defense, that a woman who kills her abusers acting in self-defense, even if she is not being attacked under that during that time period. That same year, in August 1974, a 21-year-old black woman named Joanne Little was the only female prisoner at North Carolina's Beaufort County Jail. A 62-year-old white guard named Clarence Alligood entered her cell with a vice grip, and he threatened her and he forced her to perform oral sex on her. She stabbed him and she fled, and she turned herself in 8 days later. She too was charged with first-degree murder, which in North Carolina carried a mandatory death sentence. Like the case of Inez Garcia, there was a huge outpouring of support from various movements, including people and groups involved in women's liberation movements, in black liberation movements, in community groups, in church groups. People recognized that she had had the right to defend herself against the sexual assault, and what she had done was justified. And because they raised money, she was able to get a better legal defense, so that during her trial, her defense team exposed the chronic sexual abuse and harassment endured by women in the jail and prison system in North Carolina. They countered the prosecution's argument that Little had somehow enticed Alligood into her cell with promises of sex and then killed her. And the defense team called on women who had previously been held on the jail to testify about this. So one woman testified that Alligood had fondled her breast while bringing her a late night sandwich, and another one recalled that he had suggested that she had been in jail long enough to meet a man. Little herself testified that Clarence Alligood had come to her cell 3 times that night. After she refused his advances twice, he returned with an ice pick. She told the court, "By then, I had changed into my nightgown. He was telling me I really looked nice in my gown, and he wanted to have sex with me. He said he had been nice to me, and it was time I was nice to him. I told him I didn't feel like I should be nice to him that way." After 78 minutes of deliberation, a jury acquitted Joanne Little, establishing the precedent for killing as a justified self-defense against sexual assault. And keep in mind, in both of these cases, the fact that these women had an outpouring of movement support meant that they were able to get better legal representation and were able to pursue various legal options. Now I'm going to switch over in the couple of minutes I have remaining to a couple of cases that weren't so well known and didn't capture the movement's attention. In 1973, the year before these cases, a woman named Jenna Kelsey shot and killed her ex-husband while he was beating her. Despite his history of abuse, including a nearly fatal incident in which he drove her car off the road with his truck, a jury found Jenna Kelsey guilty of second-degree murder, and in 1976, having exhausted all of her requests for appeal, she began serving a 15 to 25-year sentence. There was no mass movement that emerged to talk about the fact that she had the right to self-defense, so basically she got no support or no attention whatsoever from these various movements on the left. In Maryland of that same year, after 17 years of abuse, Barbara Jean Gilbert killed her husband. She was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Even though she lacked movement support, she appealed her conviction and was granted a new trial. She was then convicted of manslaughter. During that retrial, the prosecuting attorney did not ask for a prison sentence, and the parole and probation board recommended probation, but the judge nonetheless sentenced Gilbert to 8 years, which was the maximum penalty for manslaughter. He stated during sentencing, "You have inflicted pain and deprivation. You have snuffed out a life. Therefore, the court has the right to inflict pain and deprivation on you." And the silences around these women's cases and many other battered women who killed their abusers reflects the silence that was going on among more radical movements around the issue of abuse and battery. However, jumping towards the end of the decade, there was more awareness around the issues of abuse and battering by people in the women's movement and increasingly by people who didn't necessarily identify as radical or left or as part of the radical women's movement, which led to a watering down of an analysis as to who got beaten and why, and what the social problems were. So there was a pathologizing of battering as an individual problem. And what was the battered women's defense that Susan Jordan had actually used to argue in Inez Garcia's case became watered down into what became known as the battered women's syndrome, which basically stated that a woman learns helplessness by being battered so much. And this only applied to women who were white, middle class, and fit a profile of a very submissive domestic woman. So this left out women of color, this left out poor women, this left out women who were somehow marginalized in other ways, and basically upheld patriarchal ideas of femininity and class. In the cases of Beverly Ibn Tomas, who was convicted in 1979, and Kathy Thomas, who was convicted in 1978, the courts actually ruled out battered women's syndrome because both of them were black women who had killed their batterers and didn't neatly fit this profile of what a good wife and mother should look like, and a woman who didn't, and were women who didn't deserve to somehow be battered. Kathy Thomas was further stigmatized because she was a welfare recipient and an occasional drug user, and her boyfriend was a drug dealer, and she was convicted of murder and sentenced to 15 years. Again, there was no mass movement that emerged to support these women. There was no, like, free Kathy Thomas, free Beverly Ibn Tahmas movement like there were with Joanne Little and Inez Garcia. And also with the watering down of this analysis around battering, there was a shift in focus, which we can still see today, towards relying on the state to deal with abuse and battering through mandatory arrests and harsher sentencing. So some of these same apparatuses that we're fighting on other fronts are being used to somehow ensure the safety of women. Many women of color and radical feminists question the shift within the battered women's movement, arguing that this targeted poor people and communities of color. And when these concerns weren't addressed, many of these women left the larger and more mainstream battered women's movement. At the same time, however, many of the non-women-centered radical movements were not addressing battering and abuse at all, so there was not a different set of solutions coming from these groups either. So basically it was women had a choice to either rely on the state and call the state on their men or on their loved ones and on their communities, or to put up with this abuse in silence. So what can we learn from these examples, like looking at the 1970s and seeing what applies today? We can see that if we're not addressing the fact that we live in a society that condones gendered violence, and if we aren't coming up with solutions, then the fallback then becomes relying on prisons and policing to keep women and other marginalized and vulnerable populations safe. And we can also see that it's imperative to support women who are incarcerated for killing their abusers, as well as to support the women in our groups and in our neighborhoods and in our communities who are being abused, because abuse isolates people, and this is another tactic that's used to divide our communities. And we need to see that these two are connected, and that we should be working on both fronts to both end violence against women without strengthening government control over our lives, or by promoting incarceration as a solution to social problems. Thank you.
Thanks. So I'm going to talk a little bit about two chapters, one that I wrote and one that I that somebody else wrote, but that I know quite well and have been doing some similar research on. And I'm really glad that Kazembe, in making the flyer, put George Jackson on it, because I think it's one of several people who I think came to really represent the spirit of the 70s for the right as much as the left, in all honesty, as people, as the sort of growing movements for law and order took stride. But I think, you know, one of the things that George Jackson, who was a prisoner in California, who became a best-selling author of a book called Soledad Brother, was an associate and comrade of Angela Davis, and then was killed in San Quentin prison in August of 1971. What his work and writings both laid out but also inspired was a strong emphasis on decolonization, right? And George Jackson can be seen as part of an array of movements among particularly Black, Indigenous, Puerto Rican, and Chicano movements that were organized around the basis of decolonization. And so in the time period where, you know, issues of race and racism were on most people's minds, if not their agenda, groups like the Republic of New Africa, the American Indian Movement, and a whole host of organizations focused on imprisonment and political prisoners shifted the focus not just to be about anti-racism, but about national liberation and decolonization. And similarly, in a time period that saw many people sort of going back to the land and building sort of communes or homesteading movements, organizations like the RNA and AIM also turned to the land, right? But in a very different way than the sort of communard movement, right? Which was a mostly white and often, but not exclusively middle-class phenomenon. Right, but these were organizations that, in orienting themselves to the notion of decolonization, really put the issue of settler colonialism on the agenda, right? And defined that any sort of radical movement in the United States needed to confront the settler origins of the U.S., the colonial structure of the U.S. And so for these people, the land, right, particularly for the Republic of New Africa, the five states in the Black Belt South, South Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Mississippi, the five states where slavery had the highest concentration and where slaves had really built most of the wealth, really belonged to the new African, right? Belonged to Black people, that this was sort of the national homeland. And so the RNA tried to reclaim that land beginning in 1970. And 3 days before George Jackson was murdered in prison, the FBI tried to round up the RNA, also leading to a shootout in which one person was killed, right? And that, even more than they had been already, brought the RNA into contact and conflict with the prison system. 11 members of the organization, including most of its leadership, but also many strong rank and file members, were imprisoned for most of the decade. And their work around freeing their comrades became a pivotal aspect of the 1970s. And George Jackson was an important symbol in that, as was Malcolm X and many other murdered black radicals. But despite their imprisonment and their even from within prison, the RNA was able to launch numerous international campaigns and petitions, not only for the redress and the freedom of political prisoners, but for reparations. And this was a sort of pivotal turning point in the movement for reparations, and continued to lay out a strategy of self-determination that argued that we, as radicals, ought to practice the self-determination we sought, right? So it wasn't about sort of demanding something from the state so much as enacting it and being willing to defend it. And the American Indian Movement followed a similar path in their land reclamations of Alcatraz Prison, of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, of Wounded Knee, of a host of sort of alternative institutions that they and similar indigenous militants set up on the land. And what I think is particularly interesting about this is both their ability to bring in a lot of prisoners, right? So even more than the RNA or AIM as organizations, the ideologies of decolonization, the strategic emphasis around decolonization, appealed to prisoners, right? And prisoners became some of the leading theorists of decolonization at the exact moment that mass incarceration was on the rise. And so there's a really interesting sort of interplay between prisoners and the sort of wider movement, in which prisoners were important symbols, but were also, leading activists and organizers. And I think that cuts across both AIM and the RNA. And really their sort of shared focus on decolonization meant a sense of self-determination, self-defense, and an emphasis on land that looked not just to the cities, not even primarily to the cities, but also to the countryside. In a time period when people were really struggling for power within sort of declining cities, here were two organizations that were really putting the emphasis on the rest of the country, and sort of shifting our focus, our analysis, to look at where people were still congregated and these sort of bases of power that had been sort of bastions of reactionary politics, but had also been bastions of black and indigenous militancy. And so I think I'll just close with what perhaps is one of the most innovative slogans of the 1970s that came from the American Indian Movement, which is U.S. out of North America. Thanks. So next, I'm going to turn over to Andy Cornell, who'll talk about his chapter on the Movement for a New Society. Andy also just wrote and successfully defended a 650-page dissertation on 20th century anarchism.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for braving the rain coming out tonight. It's really a pleasure. In my chapter, I take on a different strand of these kind of multifarious movements that were going on in the 70s, but related to things that Matt and Dan have talked about and other people will talk about. I read a kind of short profile of an organization called Movement for a New Society. Anyone here familiar with that group or heard of them before? Movement for a New Society was a radical pacifist organization founded in 1971 that had its kind of was based or had its highest concentration of members in Philadelphia, but was really a network of members living all over the country in places like Ann Arbor, Michigan, or Tucson, Arizona, Boston, Savannah, Georgia, etc. And what I argue in the chapter is that although not well known by name today, Movement for a New Society was pretty pivotal and foundational in either pioneering or kind of transmitting from kind of longer movement genealogies. A lot of the practices that have become or that have that became central to anarchist politics in the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s. So a range of practices such as focus on mass nonviolent direct actions, organizing those direct actions through the spokes council method that folks who are involved in global justice organizing earlier in the decade might remember. A sense that to be really radical, in all your meetings, you had to use the consensus decision-making process rather than voting on things. The idea that it's important to call people out on their shit, that is to kind of work on internalized oppression and really spend a lot of time within movement circles trying to think about internalized sexism, homophobia, classism, and that was an important part of the work. Also living together collectively in group houses, especially in cities rather than the kind of rural communes that we've been talking about. My sense is that this was an organization that practiced and developed and experimented with a lot of these ways of doing politics that were in a sense new, but were in a sense also kind of a new iteration of ideas and practices that can be traced back to the beginning of the century through radical pacifist, anarchist, and other movements. So let me just say a couple things about them. I don't want to speak too long. Like I said, they were formed in 1971 out of a specifically Quaker group that had been doing things in the 60s, like sending boats to both North and South Vietnam with medical supplies. But they realized that they needed to do more than just confront the war. They needed to create a movement for an entirely new society that would take into account and kind of pull some of the new strands of political thinking from different movements of the 60s and kind of connect those and braid those with this radical pacifist tradition that they took up from Gandhi, but from David Dellinger, Barbara Deming, other folks in the United States in that history. But they wanted to combine that with feminism, with ecology, with thinking about the relationship between the first and the third world, or the global north and the global south, and redistributing resources. And they wanted to kind of reinvent politics as they were trying to kind of pull all these strands together. I argue that kind of came together around four aspects of their work. One was direct action. Another was what they called macro analysis, trying to think through and come up with new theories that could kind of articulate and connect these different forms of resistance to different forms of domination. Third was training, especially training in nonviolent tactics. And finally was their kind of idea of community building, which they thought of around the concept of living the revolution now, kind of a reinvention of the Gandhian idea of you have to become the change you want to see, right? And that the revolutionary has to change themselves as they're out changing the world. They did some great innovative direct action campaigns. They tried to block a shipment of arms to Vietnam in 1972 by creating a flotilla of canoes that would prevent this kind of military ship from docking. They weren't able to totally prevent it, but the kind of anti-war movement at the time was so strong that a number of the sailors jumped from the ship and swam to get on the canoes. They basically went AWOL right over the side of the ship to join the anti-war activists. So that was just an example of their direct action. They also mobilized within 2 days to kind of turn out and try to be some sense of a buffer at the Wounded Knee confrontation and place themselves between the kind of amassed forces of the state and the members of the American Indian Movement. So the direct action aspect. What's really interesting, I think, is that they tried to develop the idea of what we see now, what's often talked about as prefigurative politics, like I said, in this concept of living the revolution now. But that was a really kind of contested aspect of their legacy, I'd argue. They did form group houses, tried to live cheaply, tried to just work about 10 or 15 hours a week to support themselves so that they could be at least, you know, half or three-quarter time revolutionaries, if not full-time revolutionaries. And they did spend a lot of time in those houses kind of doing the work that I was talking about, of this kind of internalized, thinking about and trying to confront internalized forms of oppression, do some of the thinking work. But what ended up happening, a lot of them say, is that by the kind of 75, 76 period, there kind of came to be a split in the group. And they had a conflict between what they saw as the adversarial role of the organization and the exemplary role. And there was kind of a lack of clarity of if it was going to be enough to kind of live in community, to shop at a food co-op, to start a food co-op, and to try and form new social relations. If that was sufficient, if that's what it meant to be a revolutionary, or if you also had to have this really confrontational aspect of continuing to build mass direct action campaigns and try to organize a sense of a more massive withdrawal of participation in state structures. And they argued that the allure of the commune, the back to the land movement, was kind of a problem because people would circulate through some of those back to the land communes and come to Movement for a New Society and want to join that and see and think that living in community was enough of a kind of statement or an action, and that just by kind of creating the vision of what could be, people would naturally come to that. So there's a lot more to the story. I think I need to wrap up, but I think what's really interesting is that we can see a lot of these kind of tensions and frustrations and confusions around these kind of dual aspects of tactics, of adversarial relationship or opposing what is and proposing the new, kind of being exemplary. And that's still playing out today. So I think looking back at Movement for a New Society can give us some insight into how to have the balance between these two kind of necessary moments of revolutionary change. So hopefully you buy the book and see how they dealt with it. Thanks.
Like a cliffhanger. all right, y'all, you're still with us here? Everyone's awake? Good? We're almost there. So next we're going to hear from Meg Starr, one of the founders of Resistance in Brooklyn, an anti-imperialist affinity group in the city. Thank you so much. Free water for everybody. Meg has also been active in solidarity with the Puerto Rican independence movement for more than 25 years, which she's going to talk some about today, and is also the author of a children's book called Alicia's Happy Day.
Thank you. Plug. I want to... Can you hear me okay?
Yeah,
okay. So I want to just shout out to three people in the audience that I know whose work and stories have informed my whole political life. Betsy Mickle and Mike Novick and Bob Lederer. And they're all of them activists in the 70s. Ask Mike about the Brooklyn College student takeovers and anti-racism from a working class perspective. Ask Betsy about the House of D and the women's collective that tried to get women out on bail from it down here in the village. And ask Bob about the Guillermo Morales campaign. They're incredible resources. And I'm going to tell some stories and tell you, I mean, because you can read my chapter, which is on the independence movement and solidarity with it in the city, and you can read it, but I came here from New Haven, Connecticut when I was around like 1980, and somebody got me to go to an event in a Ukrainian labor home on the Lower East Side that Lolita Lebrun was doing. And I was this young lesbian feminist from New Haven looking for a more expansive kind of women's movement than I had found there. And there were all these people, men and women and children, standing up and yelling for this woman, this incredibly powerful woman. I don't think I've ever seen a woman who looked as empowered as Lolita Lebrun. And they were all yelling, Lolita dale duro, Lolito seguro a las Yankees dale duro, which means Lolito, you're doing great, hit him again. And Bob can correct me because he usually corrects me on issues of that in our collective. It's like one of the things he does. But I was blown away because I'd been looking for sort of like a feminism that was anti-racist, that included people from all over, and it seemed like I was getting to something a little different. And it was very exciting to me. And one of the things that happened to me at that time, I met people from the Black Nationalist Movement, I met white anti-imperialists who were doing solidarity work of different kinds in the Puerto Rican independentistas. And I started getting all these phone calls with this black voice on the phone saying, suck my big black dick, over and over and over again. And I had been lucky enough that while I was in college, I dated a woman who was going through the discovery files of like the activists in the 70s in New Haven. And one of the things that happened, I knew what COINTELPRO was. I mean, you could taste it, you could feel it in the air, you could tell you were being influenced by COINTELPRO lines. And one of the things that was being done was very, very specifically, different parts of the movement were being divided from each other. And I think one of the things about this book, which is fantastic, it doesn't deal as much with the state as it does with what the movements were trying to do. And so, you know, you have to kind of take this book and into it put books like this that talk about what kind of repressive apparatus was being set in place and how people were being fractured.
So it is.
Okay, this is the new Jim Crow in the age of colorblindness. And this is about like the current caste system in the United States and the setting up of it. And the groundwork, the seedwork for the war on drugs was being set up in the 70s by, you know, Nixon and Reagan. And not, you know, mostly by them, but mostly, I'm sure, by the structures that were evaluating the social movements and how to control them. So we have to take into our studies of all these activists that were, as Dan said, trying to walk the talk. We have to take into our studies of all that what was being done to them. And what was being done to take ordinary people and draw them out of the movement at all the different levels that was happening. Like the white women who were running the battered women's shelters who were overwhelmed. I mean, the first thing I did was go to battered women's shelters where I answered the phones. And the number of calls and people saying, he's coming at me with a knife. And, you know, you're being offered money and apparatus from the state. And on the other hand, the movement doesn't quite know how to deal with it. It's like coming at you, you know what I mean? And there's the division starting to happen. What's wrong with working with the police? One of the first things I did as an anti-racist young women activist was work with a group that was very, very unpopular, even satirized by Sarah Schulman in one of her early novels. The Women's Committee Against Genocide, and we had a leaflet that said, women don't work with the police. And it was about the split that was happening in the women's movement, where white women were being lured into working with the police to deal with issues of criminal justice and issues of violence against women, and things that women of color were going to have a much more complicated response to based on their experience, and a much more insightful understanding of what was happening than the white women did, who you know, I remember, you know, going out onto the street in front of my building and seeing all these homeless people being swept in one of those sweeps they did of homeless people, or trying to get them off the street, and going up to the police and saying, "Why are you doing this?" And he said, "I'm protecting white girls like you." And that, it was a line. It was like a line that was so consistent in society. It was part of, anyway. So I started thinking, when I started putting all of our different stories here together, I started thinking about the fragmentation and how it happened. And, you know, a lot of the organizations, one of the big things about the 70s was people always talked about the sectarianism of the 70s. And I started thinking about it in this context where this incredible stuff is happening in society around that was affecting people in these ways. So in my chapter, I talk a lot about the independence movement from a very, from a sort of New York perspective. And one of the things I try to do is pull together different strains in the independence movement and incorporate into things that you've probably read about the Young Lords and the Puerto Rican Socialist Party and things like that, try to incorporate in the origins of the FALN, and which is one of the armed clandestine organizations that functioned throughout the Northeast and Chicago, but a lot in New York, really. One of the first things that happened to me, I remember, is there was a kid who bounced his football on a police car and dented it, who was shot and killed by the police. And there was a Puerto Rican kid, and there was this big demonstration. And I remember being in the demonstration, because I was a daycare teacher, and so everything that happened to kids really affected me. And that was one of the first things that really struck me as an anti-racist in New York, was the things that were happening to, you know, the vulnerability of kids in the city. And so, and they put the children at the front of the demonstration. And a friend of mine who is a poet wrote the children at the front of the demonstration like young birds. And then the demonstration marched, you know, down to the police precinct. And you saw, like, the police sitting there like this army, you know, still and cold. And you felt like this hopelessness settle in your heart. And then the next day, or a few days later, the FALN bombed the MCC. They bombed MCC in a place where they couldn't hurt anybody, not like where prisoners were.
What's the MCC?
Metropolitan Correctional Center. They bombed the Metropolitan Correctional Center, the FBI building, and the police headquarters. And then they sent this message out saying, our children and our communities cannot be touched. So anyway, that was the very, this is the early 80s. It's sort of the end of, it was like an ending and a begin of the 70s and the beginning of a much colder era that leads to the new Jim Crow. But that's it.
Thank you. So the last speaker, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion and book buying, is Ben Shepherd, who's an assistant professor at the New York School of Technology, which is part of CUNY. He's a former freelance journalist who's been involved with a number of social movements, including Reclaim the Streets, ACT UP, and others, and is the editor or author of 6 books, including From ACT UP to the WTO.
Thank you, Dan. I mean, really, congratulations on this. Congratulations to all of you. It seems like, it's funny, 4 years ago it drew. I mean, I was giving a talk with Steve Duncan and Andrew Boyd, and you came up to me afterward, and you're like, you should write about that. And I'd sort of been writing my notes on the flight over from L.A. And that's 4 years ago. It's funny, here we are, 4 years later. But a lot of this project, this essay that I wrote, was a reflection of conversations. I mean, Spitzer and I over there chit-chatting about the germs in the pubs, and that's sort of where a lot of this came from as well. But I was very much interested in, 70s, I mean, I was watching Star Wars and playing, riding on big wheels in the neighborhood, so I wasn't too in radical politics at the time, but I remember
I remember in 1981 at the Inwood Theater seeing the preview for The Decline of Western Civilization. And that was like, whoa, black and white movie. And I didn't know they were being tongue-in-cheek about The Decline of Western Civilization. It was, wow, like there are people slam dancing and it's black and white and it's violent and there's starting to crash who died before the movie came out. And it was like, wow, that is something intensely powerful. But what I was interested in writing about with this chapter was how did people in the 70s build a politics, an embodied politics, a politics that we all could participate in, a do-it-yourself politics. So there's the movement, there's the big macro moments, but I didn't make it to Seattle, 68, and a lot of some people were working, they couldn't get out. So then in between some of the iconic moments, there's the day-to-day struggles that, and I think what's interesting, what I wanted to write about were how some of these subculture groups built a scene, a do-it-yourself scene, where with punk it was about zines and bands, and you didn't really have to be able to play too well as much as that you were part of something. And so I start off with a story of two groups, one of the Cockettes and one of the Germs. These are both queer, direct action, performative groups. The Cockettes were formed after George Harris, who was iconically, there's a photo of George Harris when he was leaving the East Coast. He's a preppy gentleman who lived in Westchester County, and there's a picture of him putting the flower inside of the National Guard soldier, his gun. And then he went out to San Francisco and became Hibiscus, and a genderfuck performer who was hanging out in the trees naked, and the other members of the Cockettes saw him in Golden Gate Park, thank you very much, saying, you know, join us, join us, join us, and beckoning people to join. So there's this idea that the leader was less important than the people participating, and anybody could participate. So the last day of the decade, 1969, I'll read a little paragraph. George Harris, a.k.a. Hibiscus, invites everybody over. And Hibiscus invited his new friends from the park to share a dinner of rice and vegetables and a bottle of wine in his new commune. There he announced he'd been invited to perform at the Nocturnal Dream Show, an experimental midnight movie event at the Palace Theater in San Francisco's North Beach. Hibiscus proposed that the group take their impromptu performances from the park and transform them into a new theater for a new decade. But what should we call it? Hibiscus asked the group. Something like the Rockettes. No, the Cockettes. Okay, another cauliflower member responded immediately. That was already in everyone's mind. Anyway, the Cockettes were born. Irving Rosenthal, the founder and den mother of the Cauliflower Collective, kept a drag room filled with feather boas and petticoats, and Ralph, another commune member, had a key, and they rampaged through the room, and later on in the evening, dosed with LSD and dressed in genderfuck men in beards and women's clothing, this group of men, along with women and even a few children, stumbled on stage for their impromptu, clothing optional midnight performance of the tune to the tune of Can Can. And they started dancing, and a kid whined from Jumpy Jack Flash and Honky Tonk Women followed, galvanized by the ridiculousness of the semi-clad liberatory theater. The crowd roared for more. Not having a second act, the Cockettes simply performed Honky Tonk Woman again, and the rest of the audience leaped onto stage in the reprise of the quasi-nude kick line, Mini Without Clothes. The lines between audience performer, reality, and theater dissolved. More enthusiastic than polished, the Cockettes' romp radiated spontaneous joy, both hopeful and tantalizing, and unofficial play. So the beauty of this is a moment of saying everybody, everybody perform. Everybody come up on stage. I don't think it would have been any good if it had been the Cockettes on stage. The point was, take your clothes off. There's not a leader. Let's all do this kick line together. And I think that's part of what you see with the Germs shows later on. I mean, the Cockettes performed for a few years. They did different forms of this. Divine was a part of the group. And they eventually dissolved, and some of the members of the group, and this is what I found out from one of the memoirs that Spencer lent me, as the group broke up, some of the members traveled up and down the West Coast, and some ended up in LA and helped become part of the punk scene, where, again, there was really not a lot of an emphasis on being able to play as much as being able to participate together and creating a scene. And I think this is a scene where there's blurry lines around gender, and queer we're speaking queer in really broad terms. So there's a space that's opened up that a lot of people are participating in and think transforming their own lives and their own by creating their own scenes. And I think this is the kind of DIY politics I'm still interested in today. And I think we still see that with building squats and community gardens and trying to build our own scenes as we continue. Anyway, thank you for letting me be part of the book.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Great. So we lost Matt to parental duties, but we have plenty of time for questions for everyone else that's here. Questions, comments, thoughts? You're all just like blown away. It's just like,
yeah.
Totally dumbstruck. Yeah, because I'm it.
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for this book because like, I've been the 70s have been coming up for me in a lot of different ways in terms of just like the playing out of the 60s and the fact that anything was possible, you know, and it was just like, there was like this level in which anything was like, you know, it was impossible, it was possible. Like, and like for example, like I found this really great cartoon about this guy, Doc Ellis, who that pitched a no hit on LSD, you know, and yeah. it was insane, you know, it was that was like the 70s. but for me, I'm wondering a couple of things. For me, I guess one question for me, just as a researcher, in talking about hidden histories, like how do y'all do this work, primarily without, I know, some of this history is not with secondary materials. So I'm wondering, like, what was the process in terms of you digging up your topic matter, the subject matter, that type of thing? Like, how did you go about doing that?
I just want to go down the line.
How did you get involved in this research?
Okay. Sorry, I got distracted. Daniel Burton Rose, who was originally a co-editor and then dropped out of the project, had actually knew about my work with incarcerated women and resistance organizing in women's prisons. And he called me up and said, would you be interested in writing a chapter about the women's self-defense movement of the 1970s and the support committees that and the freedom movements that grew up around Joanne Little, Inez Garcia, and Yvonne Wanro. And these were actually three women I'd never heard of before in my life. You know, so it kind of like shows this sort of like gap in like what we pass on to other people, you know, of like I'm doing this kind of research. So I started looking at their cases, and then as I was going through archives of Off Our Backs, a magazine called Aegis, Violence Against Women, and other feminist journals, I was also seeing like, as well as like articles about Joanne Little and Inez Garcia and Yvonne Wanro and a woman named Desi Woods, there were also much shorter little blurbs about like Barbara Gilbert sentenced to 17 years, you know, like Kathy Thomas, you know, but they were like a sentence or a little paragraph and there was nothing more. There wasn't like a call for action. There wasn't a call for people to go pack the courtroom. There weren't fundraisers being on their behalf. And so I started thinking like, well, what about all these other women? They fall under this rubric of, you know, self-defense. And it's kind of like picking and figuring out like what there is and like what's not being told and kind of trying to follow, you know, follow those leads. I'm also not trained as an academic, so my research is like a big hodgepodge of stuff where like, you know, like I found, you know, people who were active in the 1970s and early 1980s that were part of their support committees, and I grabbed them and, you know, like made them sit down and talk to me about what it meant to be part of those support committees and also why those same support committees weren't doing work around women who had been incarcerated for killing their abusers. And it was really interesting to listen to their responses, you know, 30, 40 years later, which is that like this wasn't necessarily something that they saw as being part of the revolutionary agenda. Like people from the Republic of New Africa said that, people who were involved in the women's liberation movement that were doing support work for Joanne Little and Inez Garcia also said this, that basically like battering and abuse was a personal issue, it wasn't a political issue. And then talking with women from who had been radical feminists and part of the start of the battered women's movement, saying that because there wasn't the support, you know, or this like big push towards politicizing abuse, you know, they kind of got pushed out when it became more mainstream and people were getting jobs and, you know, like going to like school for social work and ending up in these kind of positions in women's shelters where they kind of made this an individual problem instead of looking at like a social criticism of like who gets beaten up and why. So I think I went off topic. So it's kind of like a weird hodgepodge of things. finding people, finding instances, and kind of like trying to follow up on what I found.
Yeah.
But I mean, maybe people who have better training have different answers for you.
I mean, maybe I can just follow up with that. I'm thinking specifically like how do you talk to people about like this hidden history, this issue like the Black Liberation Army, the Liberation National Front, the Puerto Rican Liberation, and like I guess part of it is how I've done like some undergraduate research on the Black Liberation Army, and I wrote my undergraduate thesis on it, but I never really quite felt like that level of comfort in terms of like being going up to somebody and be like, hey, like, you know, in the New York Times said 1974, you did this action, do you want to talk about it? You know, it's like, you know, like, so like, how do you as a researcher, you know, and a scholar, like it's maybe something you talk about too, which is like go to these primary individuals and like talk about this stuff in a respectful way, in a way that, I don't know, does that make sense? Like, how do you get over that? How did you get over that maybe initial discomfort of talking about those part of those hidden histories that most people are like maybe a little bit shy to talk about? Or maybe that's like, I don't know.
Yeah. You're picking something.
I really came into this by stumbling into oral history methods. And so, which I think is a great methodology. It's just, I think a lot of people will, if you're respectful, they'll share their story with you. And so I think it's digging into finding people who are willing to share their story and seeing what's out there. That's the most fun part. I mean, that's sort of how I've come into writing about queer politics in San Francisco in the 70s. I started writing, doing oral histories about HIV, and I found that people really wanted to talk about the 70s. That was really important to them. While I went there thinking it was going to be HIV/AIDS was the story, but it was like, no, it was coming to San Francisco after the Vietnam War and building a community in the space. So I think, and then you start the sample and you keep on asking people, you know, who else is, they call this snowball sampling, but ask for a couple more names without being pushy or annoying. But I think the conversation really starts from there. And I think people, if you're respectful and you've done a little homework, people are willing to talk. I don't know, that's my impression. I mean, especially with recent history like this, I mean, it's available, but it's a matter of digging it up, so.
And I'll just add to that, I mean, obviously the group like the BLA, I mean, there's sort of legal issues that people may or may not want to get into, but I think that issue of trust is really important, and which is why for the book, really wanted to emphasize people who are based in social movements, right, rather than people who you know had a degree around it necessarily, I mean, although some of us do, but really that trust is based on the political work that people do and get the sort of respect for doing, and so I think that's, I don't think a book like this could have been written right entirely by academics, because I think that trust wouldn't exist between the people who right were doing that stuff and those oral histories that are so critical, so.
Let me just say one more thing very quickly. I think what's amazing about this book is you read these chapters and you don't know if they were written by an academic historian or not until you flip to the back and kind of look at the contributors. And I think that was a bit of a challenge for Dan to get this university press to put this out because there's a sense of like needing credentials. But I think it's something of a myth, Kazembe, of like, you know, there's this great training that you get in the like 7 years of a PhD program. Having just finished that myself and talking to so many other people, they're like, I never got shit for training on like how you dig through an archive and construct an argument. All it is paying for the time to kind of do it over and over again and to read and to have some other people to kind of read your stuff and like correct your sentences and things like that. So archives are out there and there's so much material of kind of recent left history that's just sitting there and that is like fascinating. And almost all those archives, even if they're at a university, are open to the public if you just show that you're serious about it. Most of the archivists are there and they're stoked about what they have and they want someone who's interested in it to come and talk to them and write about it.
Right.
So just go do it and just keep working on it and like, don't waste 7 years going to grad school to like.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good. Yeah, Bob.
Yeah, well, I really applaud all of you on this book. This is a really important contribution to to whatever generation you come from, to understanding this critical period. I haven't read it yet, so my question is not coming from, I carefully reviewed it and something's missing, but it is a question about what appears to be missing, and I wonder, both from Dan as the editor and those of you who contributed, what you think about two iconic movements of the 70s, or parts of movements that are not do not appear to be represented. And I say that acknowledging that it's really crucial that you included the most radical wing of the Black movement, the Chicano movement, and the Puerto Rican movement, and the Indigenous movement, and those have often been neglected. But that is, while there is the issue of women's self-defense against violence, the broader women's liberation movement, which had incredibly radical anti-imperialist and socialist wings, I don't see that here at all. And that not only, made a major contribution to the development of feminist consciousness and changing of conditions of women's lives in all classes and races, but also kind of infused the other movements with the issues about feminism and challenging patriarchy. And I don't see that. And the other thing is, well, it's great, Ben, that you wrote about the cultural kind of liberatory currents within the gay movement and community building. The gay movement, the political wing, the radical political wing of the gay and lesbian movement in this period was extremely powerful,
mm-hmm.
and fought some major battles against the right wing.
Right.
And then there were internal battles within that movement about, are we going to link our struggle to the battle against
sure.
racism, or are we just going to basically fight for middle class white gay men?
Mm-hmm.
So those are my questions. I know it's always tough to put everything, you can't put everything in
right.
to any anthology, that's a given. But how did you make those choices, and in particular, what did you think, and what did the other folks think about the absence of those two wings of the movies?
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for the question. So a few things to say about it. I think both of those movements, but especially the women's liberation movement, are in several of the other chapters as sort of intersecting with right, their influences on other movements or the ways that they were sort of a part of these other groups that are being described in James Tracy's chapter, talking about the different sort of community-based organizations in sort of multiracial but white working class communities. Sort of the women's movement is a sort of constant thread of that chapter and several of the others. I think the challenge with a book like this, with something called Hidden Histories of an era that's very recent and has a sort of spotty historical record, is trying to have the breadth of all these different movements and trying to stay true to the title, which is right, uncovering those histories that have not been hidden. And so the challenge of that is, the one movement that people do associate with the 70s is the women's liberation movement. And so trying to find those stories that have not been told, of which there are many, right? And particularly the radical edges of the women's liberation movement are precisely those ones that have not been covered as much as the sort of mainstream, NOW and NARAL and similar sort of groups. We tried to do what we initially and then what I could. And I think, I'm happy, very happy, certainly with Vicky's chapter, I think you get not just the work around the defense campaigns, but the materials that she uncovered about who was involved in those campaigns. It sheds all this light on many corners of both the women's liberation movement and the queer movement, and also these different revolutionary nationalist movements. The other thing I'll say is that when this book started, the hope for it was to blend more sort of historical essays with a variety of first-person pieces from different movement contributors that could sort of talk from more rooted from within these movements. And we had several lined up, and particularly a couple around women's liberation movement and the queer movement that in my mind were sort of paired, right? The sort of one around the queer movement was going to be paired with Ben's piece, and the publisher man's cut it.
just for space reasons?
And also they didn't like the pairing of first person pieces with sort of overarching historical pieces. So it was more of a style political reason than a space reason. So that's what I'll say, but if other folks want to add to that, I'm welcome to it. Michael and Dan.
I'll just put a couple of things out quickly. Having lived through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and got into the 2010s, to me the really critical thing is what we can sort of extract from those histories and struggles. And I really appreciated kind of Vicky's remarks and also Meg's in terms of looking at the strengths and weaknesses and the internal contradictions. I don't know how much the whole book deals with that or not, but I think the question of sectarianism is probably important, and I don't know how much it's looked at. I had a similar reaction having lived through like Bay Area liberation, June 2018, like a gay men's socialist, feminist, anti-imperialist organization in San Francisco, at the same time as, Cockettes and the System of National Indulgence and Harvey Milk. I mean, there's a lot of different things going on,
right,
and a lot of different politics contending. And I guess what I want to say is the arc of the 70s, to me, is that at the beginning of the 70s, there were mass insurgent movements in this country. And the empire was actually quite a bit on the defensive. And by the end of the 70s, a very successful counterinsurgency had taken place, and counter-revolutionary forces held sway to a great extent. And I'm wondering to what extent the book looks at that, because I think you said that the state is not much in it, and that's sort of troubling to me, because the state was in it.
I guess I'll start. I think the state is in it, right? I mean, it's in sort of all of the chapters. But the book is not trying to do a sort of political analysis of the state in the 70s. And it's trying to do a social analysis of the various opposition forces. And so the state is present, right? I mean, as I think you heard in Vicky's chapter, in Andy's chapter, certainly in my own chapter, the chapters on prison abolition. So I think the state is consistent throughout the book and throughout the sort of changing fortunes of the 70s, but that the book itself is not trying to be like, here's the state in the 70s, right? But here are these many movements in the 70s. So I think that's the difference. I don't know if that's a fair interpretation of your comment, but that would be what I would say as the editor. And I think the sort of basic arc of the 70s that you laid out is roughly true, but also it changes a great deal depending on the sort of movement vantage point that you're looking at. And so I think there were still many mass demonstrations that were happening in the late 70s. Certainly the anti-nuclear movement, even the independent Puerto Rican independence movement had the tremendous victories in 1977 and 1979 were tons of mass demonstrations. So obviously, it's sort of the arc of it is true. Not trying to deny that the decade started with Richard Nixon and ended with Ronald Reagan, but there was still a lot happening.
Oh yeah.
In terms of mass mobilizations.
You know, I think in terms of what you're saying, is I think this book, in some ways, is a response to other histories of the 70s. I don't think it's purporting to be a book that's about the 70s overall. This is simply saying, here are a whole bunch of voices that many of the other history of the 70s, not to mention names, totally negate. And so in other words, like there is even of the more radical parts of the women's movement, there's more stuff out there than, so this is, in some ways, it's a countering of a lot of earlier history of the 70s, and it's sort of like saying, we're here, there are many of us, we're very diverse, and we all did stuff in the 70s, And it's not the full picture. And some of my talk was when I started looking at all these different parts of the 70s, your head immediately goes to what the fuck happened. And then I wanted to say, now I want, I think it's like a step towards putting something together that could really synthesize the 70s more honestly and more, you know, like, and in a more complicated and real way. So that's where it is, and that's where, like, I urge people to pair it with some study of, like, the new Jim Crow and things that would put in some of the other parts to it, you know.
Was every chapter that I skimmed through had some aspect of radical community building in it? I mean, you all talked about that before yesterday. Something about radical communities. And I was wondering, like, with these new formed radical communities, how they dealt with things like violence, homophobia, sexism, racial chauvinism. Like, not only from that was coming from the outside, but within their own ranks too, in their own communities.
I can start off with that one. It became central to Movement for a New Society, and in part, what I'm writing about is the shifting focus and the kind of decisions, whether they are made explicitly or kind of developed organically in the moment, of where the energy and effort was going to go into. So I think what had started as this idea of let's build kind of, in the case of this group, is let's build some kind of collective houses in a neighborhood where we can live cheaply so that we can have more time to prepare ourselves to go to the barricades, became more of a focus on doing a lot of conversations about thinking about, like I said, internalized sexism, homophobia, racism, et cetera. And people regret that that language took on a really kind of divisive, kind of righteous and moral tone. Some of the members that I talked to look back on that and they're like, this was some powerful stuff, and like we felt like we were kind of making some breakthroughs and connecting these issues, kind of, you know, the emergence of an intersectional analysis and some of that. But in a way they really tore themselves apart and made the kind of for living conditions where people didn't want to stick around all that long. And one comment that one of the members said, I think, was pretty crucial. She said they started out in 71 with this kind of great analysis of what was going on in the world, and they had predictions and a vision of how things would develop and how their organization would facilitate kind of radical change. They got so involved in kind of doing the internal work and kind of dealing with racism or, you know, kind of feeling of sexist slights, etc., that kind of took their energy, and they weren't able to kind of think on the structural level and like analyze what it meant that that Reagan had come to power, that PATCO had been busted, that there's this big shift of the white working class and, you know, become Reagan Democrats, etc. So I think we get a lot of that today, as I think there's so much that movements today have learned from some of that thinking they're doing, but it did come at a cost of their kind of action out in the world too. So it's always difficult to balance.
I mean, Bob, I'm still thinking about your question, trying to think of a good answer, but I think Eric Rofus, we all know, he died a few years ago. One of the projects that Eric Rofus was putting together was his, he called it his 70s book, which is oral histories of gay men in the 70s. And one of our last correspondences before he died in 2006, we were talking about that porous line between the people that were in the baths going to see the bands and the party people and the people that were doing the organizing against propositions on the West Coast and Orange Tuesday, and people like Cleve Jones or Vito Russo could cross those lines and be in both worlds, but not everyone was. And yet, both movements, they both supported each other. I mean, one of the things I talk about in my chapter is Chicago Gay Liberation Front and zapping the AMA. And there's this, I think one of the most profound things the gay liberation movement did in the 70s is get the classification, the pathology classification thrown out. It's, I mean, major win, and it happened from direct action, but I have to think that having spaces for people to be able to, in cultural spaces helps. You know, so, I think you open up really interesting questions there. And Eric said to me at the end of one of our correspondences, he said, you know, the play people weren't doing the politics. I mean, maybe there was Scott Tucker, maybe he was doing a little bit of the overlap, some of the leather people, but for the most part, there's still this divide, the cultural activists divide, and between the cultural people and the people doing the political work and coming to the Brecht Forum, and yet, the activists still need the culture people to create the parties. You know, and get more people to come. And so I think, how do we infuse each other? I mean, that's what I was thinking about as I wrote my essays. How do these things overlap? I've seen it when they do. It's fantastic when those two worlds overlap, but it unfortunately doesn't. It's not enough. So anyway.
To address some of your question, like in there's some groups, like as I talked about earlier, that just didn't address, like, particularly like gender violence or intimate violence. Like, we see this over and over with like narratives of the Black Panther Party, the Republic of New Africa, even people who are doing mass defense work around women who killed men who had assaulted them but weren't their loved ones or intimate partners, you know. And then there was this idea that, like, you know, like women who stayed in these relationships, like, somehow, like, were less worthy of support. This was a personal issue. You couldn't build a movement around it. But there were also places in which, you know, people did organize. In some pockets in the 1970s of the women's liberation movement, women had formed these groups where basically they would move into an abuser's house, like if there was abuse going on, and they would basically act as round-the-clock bodyguards until this guy got so fed up that he moved out. You know, this is like, you know, like obviously not something that's like a long-term sustainable thing where you just kind of like en masse move in. But I think that when it was reported in some small lesbian journal from like 1973, they'd already done this 5 times with success, where basically this man was so fed up with these women watching his every move that he was like, I'm out of here. You know, it doesn't necessarily change the fact that, it doesn't necessarily make him realize that he shouldn't do this to anybody else, but it stopped the immediate abuse. And this has happened again, the East Harlem neighborhood in like the mid-1980s, where people in East Harlem realized that they didn't want to call the cops and bring cops into their communities and into their homes, and they also realized that they wanted to protect their neighbors. So we see that people come up with these ideas in these resourceful ways. In 1979 in Boston, a series of Black women were raped and murdered and found on the streets, and the police weren't doing anything about it. And people in the community were so upset about this that they formed something called the Dorchester Green Light Project, in which basically they would go door to door and call community meetings and talk to people and say, would you be willing to make your house be a safe house? You know, like, so that if a woman is walking down the street and she feels unsafe, you put this green light bulb on your porch when you're home that indicates that your house is safe and she can go and chill out in there and like wait for the danger to pass or call a friend to come and escort her home or something. And it basically set up the system where they weren't relying on the police, who could care less that Black women were being assaulted and murdered, you know, and they weren't relying on the state, and they were actually taking a proactive stance around protecting their communities. So people have addressed these, but like, it seems like, again, like we don't have like the overarching record of ways in which people do this to draw on, to be like, hey, we, you know, we don't need to necessarily be like the state or ignore. Like, let's like think of other ways that we as a community can do this. But some of this also comes from like on the ground community building. Like, people have done like support groups for battered women or survivors of sexual assault, and it's kind of building that trust so that people, when there is a problem, can go to that group or that community and say, hey, this happened to me and I need support and I need help and I need to figure out what I want that solution to look like, you know, and give them that space. So it's not like a cut and dry, like, if A happens, you do B, and then C will happen, and then we will all go do D. Like, it's more of a like process in each case.
And I'll just add a little bit to that. I mean, you know, it's obviously a very important consideration in any notion of community, right, is the ways in which community is being challenged or undermined. And a lot of organizations, if not whole movements, were really threatened or undid themselves in just the ways that you're talking about. But the last chapter of the book is a profile of an organizer named Madama Thunderhawk, who was involved in basically every major indigenous sort of uprising of the period, from the occupation of Alcatraz to the standoff at Wounded Knee in 1973. But the article really looks at everything that happened after Wounded Knee, which is when most histories of indigenous militancy stop. And, you know, people were really focused on all of the trials and the defense efforts to come out of that. And, you know, Madonna was around that too, but she was also building the We Will Remember Survival School and starting these alternative institutions that were mostly women-run, right, and building a strong women's community in the sort of front-runner of the sort of intersectional politics or women of color feminism that Vicky's talking about as well. And I think those were some of the more successful examples of communities because they were, you know, responding to these sort of multiple issues simultaneously and emerging oftentimes because men or other folks with a great deal of privilege didn't want to, right, be operating in that function, didn't want to or didn't, weren't able to do that. But in Madonna's case, it's also because a lot of the folks were either doing time or facing time and were so monopolized by their confrontation with the state that that they weren't paying attention to, you know, taking care of the kids and sustaining the community beyond that.
I had a question that maybe goes back a little bit to what Kazemi was talking about. This may be in some extent a suggestion, but some of the work I had done sort of professionally is as an archivist. And I'm sort of curious about the ways in which being a researcher can sort of veer into becoming an archivist, particularly, you know, if you're discovering these hidden 70s, these hidden stories, and if you're doing original research with people, maybe you come across these people and you come across their stuff that might just be in their house or their garage or in storage. And, you know, as a researcher, it would be really great to go through their stuff and you sort of synthesize them into a chapter. But I mean, I'm wondering to what extent, after that point, have you sort of stepped in and say, hey, you know, you should think of, you know, figuring out where this stuff's going to go after, you know, whatever, you know, correspondence or, you know, Vicky, it sounds like a lot of your research was journals, which, you know, like, I just picked this up. And it's like, you know, in 20 years, you know, could I find this if someone wasn't thinking about how to preserve it?
State Historical Society of Wisconsin.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I know I'm interested in supportive archives, and I'm interested in how much of, when you're doing research into these things and you're finding these people, you know, I don't know, it's sort of an open question, but, you know, like the guy you did research on this Movement for a New Society, you know, was their stuff in an institution, or did you have to like go to people's houses and things like that? And then after you did go to people's houses, did you then suggest, you know, hey, you should think of?
Well, I'll answer that directly. They had put a lot of their stuff into an archive, the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, which is the biggest collection of radical pacifist material in the country. But I think when I started digging around and I wrote this chapter and another version had came out a little earlier, they were really excited by how many people were excited by what they did and didn't know about what they did only 30 years ago. So it's been really productive in that I've been able to do a back and forth on doing a small book that has some of their voices in it as well, kind of with the material in the chapter, and reprint some of their most, what I see as their most important documents that are still relevant for today. So that's just to say there's different ways we can think about history that, again, veer away from the like professional researcher, and they're like, I'm just someone who's in dialogue, I know there's some other people who want to hear about this, tell us about it, let's put it out in the world. And with the, you know, with the state of, I think, radical publishing as it is, there's a lot of resources to do some of that and put it out there. So,
You know, one of the things for me about this project and some other work I've done is really showed the need for more movement archives and sort of movement institutions, because even though the archivists at many professional libraries are excited about the general public or anyone using them, a lot of people in the general public don't know that or feel comfortable getting into the, you know, university to look at that papers. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time in basements and attics and was very grateful to everyone who opened theirs up to me and did encourage several people to donate their materials. And one person did so because they lived near a place called the Freedom Archives, which is in San Francisco and is a movement archive. And one person in Chicago has not, because there's not a movement archive near them, right? And so, unfortunately, they're yellowing in her basement. But you know, the urgency of it was also brought home in doing this project, because one of the articles talks about an organization called the October 4th Organization in Philadelphia, and when they decided to disband in the late 1970s, they were so worried both about the state and state repression, but also about the sort of far right and the sort of fascist threat, that they actually burned their archives so that it wouldn't fall into the wrong hands. So it's tragic, as both as a historian and, you know, wanting to learn from these histories that think of what was lost.
Yeah,
I know,
still has it.
That's true. So unless there are any other questions, maybe we'll just close it up here, and we're around informally, and books in the back. So thank you all very much.
I'm just going to say, I don't know, on November 13th, there's going to be a memorial for Marilyn Buck, who was a long-time dedicated activist who'd been in prison a very long time, a white anti-imperialist who'd done tremendous solidarity work with the Black Liberation Army and movements. And it's going to be a memorial and a benefit for a lot of people in prison, political prisoners in New York State, who she wanted to help support with some of the money being raised around her. So the 70s live on in a lot of ways, and people in New York can come to that.
There's palm cards for it by the door.
If anybody's interested, I have postcards here to Attorney General Holder and also to the judge in Los Angeles who is deciding on the sentencing for Johannes Messerly, the cop who killed a young man named Oscar Grant on the BART system in Oakland. He was convicted of involuntary manslaughter with a gun enhancement and could be sentenced anywhere from 14 years to released on time served. So I've got postcards here that both of those two holders to have a federal indictment of the cop.
Thank you all very much.